All right, let's turn back to the book of Ezekiel and go ahead and turn to the text in your Bible. And also, it looks like page 157 in your book. And I'm going to pick up where we left off last week with that really, really long chart or table in your book. So before I get there, let me kind of give you a little running start again with this. And this is going to not only be helpful for us with Ezekiel, but also with Daniel. So remember last week, I gave you six. You know, just because you write the number six doesn't mean you're about to talk about six things. That's what I get when I'm rushed trying to get in here. But I gave you three dates that I think are really important to help us better understand Ezekiel and also Daniel. And so I'm going to put these back up here because they really do form good. And this is B.C., you know, before Christ is born. I get off a lot when I'm trying to go through something. And I think that's why it takes me a while. But I got to say this. I am not, in case you're wondering, I am not a fan at all of this C.E. and B.C.E. designation of the timeline of history. All that is trying to eliminate Christ from the history of our world and the way we designate dates for things. So for the longest time, it's always been 605 BC or AD, you know, whatever the year is that represent that time was split, you know, when Christ was born. And then all of a sudden, because we got more secular and anti-God, then you started seeing CE and BCE, which stands for Common Era, and I think before Common Era, instead of the designation that we've used for centuries. So anyway, I'm just not a fan of that, and since you asked, I thought I'd throw it out there. Just had to get it off my chest for a minute. So 605 BC, or here's why these are important. Remember that the whole empire, Babylon, comes over, and they are attacking Jerusalem, Judea. And as they do so, they deport different peoples at different times. Now, that's important for us because in 605 BC is when Daniel was taken into exile and ended up over there in Babylon. In 597 BC is when Ezekiel was taken in exile and then in captivity over in Babylon. And then the third time that the king of Babylon, who was Nebuchadnezzar, the third time he came over, that's kind of what I call then the final destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. So there were stages that the king of Babylon went through as he deported people from Judea. And then when he finally destroyed and overtook the entire city of Jerusalem and destroy the temple and walls. Now, I say this because tonight we're finishing with the story or the book of Ezekiel. So Ezekiel was taken in 597 in the midst of the constant attack of the Babylonians. And when we get to it, Daniel was actually taken 8 years before Ezekiel. So he was already over there with his deportation and captivity, and then Ezekiel ends up following him as he goes. And then from our last book, the book of Jeremiah, remember that Jeremiah, while these two were taken over to Babylon, he was still home in Jerusalem. And that's where he was prophesying. So all of these prophets, you know, it's kind of confused, and they're very long books, large books. But if you understand the timeline and how they fit, they all are serving a very specific purpose in their preaching ministry during this time of the Babylonian attacks and deportation and all of that. So I hope that helps as you go through the books. So we started last week with Ezekiel, and we put him in the context. The key word we talked about at the bottom of 157 was Ezekiel was called to be God's watchman, and that's in chapter 3 and chapter 33 of the book. And then we connected that to us as watchmen, as ambassadors today, and what that can look like and what it means.
We then left off at the bottom of page 158 with this table or this chart. So let me start by asking Val. Anybody who wasn't here last week that didn't get this handout, let me know. And I'll. This is just kind of a cheat to make it easier with this chart, because there's a lot. Oh, Billy, well, you don't even have a book. You're so unprepared. No, hold on. Since I was mean to him, let me give you a hug and tell you I love and appreciate it. Okay. And you can pay me later for that. Okay. All right. Anyway, see, I like Wednesday nights. Oh, how about that? We're going to send you back overseas somewhere. All right. So here's what I was trying to do. Ezekiel, this chapter in the workbook is entitled God's Actor. And while Ezekiel obviously preached and used words to get the message out, he also is probably more famous for the actions that God led him to be a part of. The chart or table on page 158 and goes to the next page as well. There is a lot in there. So what I gave you last week is what would be in that chart. And like I said, you can either just fold this and put it in your book, or you can write it into the chart and keep it all together. What I want to do is not, I can't go through all of this because it would take us too long. And I really would like to get through the Old Testament before Jesus comes back. But if he does come back before we're done, we're not going to complain. Honestly, not going to really complain about that. But let me do just a little explanation of the chart. So Ezekiel is called upon to do what we would consider some very strange things. And you see those in that handout I gave you. So you don't have to turn to all these passages, but as you read through the book, you come across these different kind of prophetic actions that Ezekiel ends up doing. So I'm going to look at it in the Bible as I go, and if you want to turn, you can. So in chapter 4, the very first command or action that Ezekiel takes part in is this idea of drawing a map of Jerusalem. Now, it sounds really weird, but when you look in chapter 4 in the first verse, God says to Ezekiel, son of man. Oh, by the way, I love that designation for Ezekiel. It's in there a lot, you know, son of man. Get yourself a brick, okay? And then place that brick before you and inscribe a city on that brick. And the city I want you to inscribe on that brick is the city of Jerusalem. Okay, that's where your your chart is getting this from, that he's going to draw a map. So he's basically going to draw, draw Jerusalem on this brick. And God says, when you do that, then I want you to lay siege against that brick. Build a siege wall. Okay, so you think about kids playing in a sandbox. I told y'all this before, but I still would love to do this. When we were little, we had those little, I think they were called Tonka, Brian. Them little metal, well, they're probably plastic now and don't last as long, but those little metal Tonka trucks and dump trucks and stuff, and me and my brother would get out there in that little patch of dirt and sand, and we're just like digging and moving dirt and bagging and dumping that. And you know what? I don't think I'm the only one. If they would just let me, the next time they clear some land somewhere for another housing development, if they would just let me have the key. And I know, Larry, that's a holy grunt right there. And if they just let me have the key where I could dig and dump into a dump truck and drive it and dump it, that would be so much fun. But anyway, so Ezekiel is kind of like in a sandbox here is the way I look at it. He's got a brick. He draws a picture and inscribes a picture on that brick, picture of Jerusalem. Then I want you to build some siege walls against that brick, raise up a ramp. You've got some camps there. Place some battering rams against that brick all around. Then get an iron plate. Set it up as an iron wall between you and the city. Set your face toward that so that it is under siege and besiege it. Okay, that's crazy. But then he explains, this is a sign to the house of Israel. Okay,
every action that sounds weird that Ezekiel does, it's a sign. Okay, it's not only a sermon that he gives with his mouth, but it's a sign he does in action to convey the message.
So the message is, when you draw Jerusalem on that brick and then surround it, that is symbolizing that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, is going to lay siege to the city of Jerusalem. So he can preach it, but not only preach it, now actually demonstrate it with a little model. That's what he does. Then it gets even more weird. In verses 4 and 5, it says to Ezekiel, "I hope your back is not real bad. You're about to lay down for a long time." Ezekiel, verse 4, "As for you, I want you to lie down on your left side." I mean, it's right there. It's lay down right there on your left side. "And when you do that, then lay the iniquity of the house of Israel on it, on your side." And I don't know what that looked like. You know, did he write it out on a piece of paper and put it on? I don't know exactly how he did that. "But take the iniquity of Israel, lay it on your side, and you shall bear their iniquity for the number of days that you lie on your side. I have assigned you a number of days corresponding to the years of their iniquity." Now here's the bad news. Laying on your side, yeah, you know, maybe a couple days to convey the message. But he's like, no, we got a reason for this, Ezekiel. So it says there the number of the years of their iniquity is 390 days. Now you imagine if you went to Walmart every day for 390 days consecutively, and every day you go by, you look, and there's that crazy nut Ezekiel. Lay it on his side, because he's trying to convey a message. Or what's the message? Look in the right-hand column. The message is, you are bearing the northern kingdom, Israel, bearing their sin for 390 years. That is a number of years of their iniquity. I'm not sure exactly when you start that dating and end that dating, but from God's perspective, there's almost 400 years they've turned away from me. So what you're going to do is lie on your side for 390 days to symbolize those years so they can see clearly this is what they've done to me for almost 400 years. Now Ezekiel got done with those days and thought, whew, glad that task is over. Well, guess what? Flip over on the other side now. Like, do what? Because you know, if you're cooking a hamburger on the grill, you always flip it, right? So Ezekiel, you're going to flip on the other side. So then in verses 6 through 8, then he says, "Now when you've completed those, then you're going to lie down a second time, but this time it's going to be on your right side. And now you're going to bear the iniquity of the house of Judah." Okay, remember Israel, northern kingdom. Now you're going to do the same thing for Judah, the southern kingdom. "On your right side and bear the iniquity of the house of Judah. I have assigned it to you for 40 days, a day for each year. And then you're going to set your face toward the siege of Jerusalem with your arm bared and prophesy against it." And so the story goes on. He lies on the left side to represent the years of iniquity of the northern kingdom, then lies on his right side to bear the iniquity of the southern kingdom. Okay, see, this is weird stuff, right? We're just not, you know, we don't think about it, but this is what Ezekiel had to do. And if you looked at Ezekiel, you would say, this dude's got some mental problems, right? I mean, honestly, he's mentally unstable. But no. This was God conveying his message through these actions in Ezekiel's life. And I got to say, to me, it took a lot of faith on Ezekiel's part to do what God said, because he looked like a weirdo. I mean, truly, he really looked like a weirdo. And let me take a quick application from that. In the world in which we live today, you don't have to do stuff this strange anymore to look like a weirdo. You just got to actually stand for truth to look for a weirdo in our day and time. Right? All the stuff going on. So that was the third example. Then the next example of action later in chapter 4. And I'm taking too long. I got to go quicker because I don't want to get bogged down. And you can read this later. But then he says to Ezekiel, chapter 4, starting at verse 9, "You're going to cook a meal. And when you cook the meal, you're going to eat the food after it has been cooked over cow manure." Now it starts off actually as human manure, human dung, and Ezekiel's like, but hold on, I don't want to defile myself with that. God says, don't use human, we'll use cow manure. Now that sounds gross, and it truly does. But why was he doing that? Well, look at the symbol of it in the next column. Once they go into exile here, when they get there, they are going to be eating defiled food. So Ezekiel, you are symbolizing that now, the way you're eating, trying to convey the message to the people. And you'll remember that when Daniel got there, remember one of the first tasks or challenges Daniel had was to eat the king's delicacies and the king's food? And Daniel's like, no, I'm not defiling myself with this, this way of eating. So Ezekiel says, when you get there, you're going to end up eating defiled food that you would never imagine trying to eat as a Jewish person in Jerusalem. So he symbolizes that. Oh my goodness, time for a haircut, Francis. Look at the next one. So in chapter 5, and again, I'm trying not to go so slow and I'm having trouble here. So if you read through the verses, God says to Ezekiel, it's time for a haircut. So first verse, take a sharp sword. Now, take a sword, use it as a razor. I have never tried to cut my hair with a sword before, but I think I should try and see how it works. Anyway, I got to be careful with that though, because it would be very hard to do. But the reason I got to be careful with that is years and years and years and years and years ago, when we first moved here, I had to go get haircut and didn't know where to go. And I noticed the prices kept going up. And then one day I was in Olive's and I saw these things called hair clippers for $19.97. And I said, I think we can do this. So for the past 12, 15 plus years, Rhonda's been snipping around my ears and cutting my hair. That's why I say I got to be careful if we use a sword. Because she might be mad at me when she's cutting my hair with a sword. Next thing you know, then there'd be a funeral. And we don't want that. So he says to Ezekiel in his day and time, this is what they would have used to kind of trim the hair, cut the hair. So Ezekiel, you're going to cut off your hair of your head, hair of your beard. Now here's what you're going to do with it though. And I don't think, Francis, you ever did this when you cut hair. I bet you never divided it up into thirds in different piles. No, she didn't. But Ezekiel, you're going to do that. So take a third of the hair. You're going to take one third of it and burn it. Take one third of it, strike it with your sword, and take the other third and just scatter it up to the wind. Oh my goodness, that's weird. Why? Well, look at the symbol. When God comes in to destroy Judah, 586, because remember Ezekiel's prophesying about what's about to happen in about 11 years. When God destroys Judah, a third of the people would die by plague or famine. A third will die by the sword in battle. And a third will be scattered as exiles. And they will end up over in Babylon. Everything Ezekiel is doing is conveying the message from God. Oh, then you turn to chapter 12. Then Ezekiel is told to take a vacation. And it's not what you would expect, and probably not what you would want to do. So Ezekiel, act like you're taking a trip. Pack your suitcases. And in their context, which seems weird to us, but pack your suitcases. And then you're going to kind of secretly escape through the night. And the way you're going to do that is dig through the wall there of your home and structure. And then at nighttime, escape through that wall. You've got your baggage and you're going to go bye-bye. All right, but why am I doing that? Well, you read in the text that when the king of Babylon comes over in 586, his name is Nebuchadnezzar, when he comes over, the king of Judah at the time, who was Zedekiah, is going to attempt to escape. And it's in there. You're going to read this later with the destruction of the temple. He tries to escape as an exile of the people. And what happens is when he gets to the king of Babylon, they put out his eyes. So what Ezekiel is doing is trying to give the people a picture ahead of time of his escaping at nighttime with his bags packed, because that's what the king of Judah is going to attempt to do when Nebuchadnezzar comes over for that destruction. Then later in chapter 12, very simple short statement in verses 17 through 19, he says in verse 18, when you eat, I want you to eat your food with trembling and drink your water with quivering and anxiety. Like, act like you're scared to death as you sit down to eat. Why is that? Because, next column, when the people of Jerusalem, when this horrible attack occurs, when they end up in Babylon, they're going to be filled with so much fear and anxiety, they're going to tremble with fear. So you're given a picture of that ahead of time. Then, in chapter 21, Ezekiel is told, a couple of verses there, verses 6 and 7, I want you to go. Now, it's not saying this, I'm just going to throw it out there. I want you to go out there to the Walmart parking lot as people are coming and going. And out there in the middle of the parking lot near the entrance doors, I want you to groan with a breaking heart and bitter grief. And it's groan and groan and groan in their sight. Why do I do this? It will come about when they say, why are you groaning like this? It's going to be because of the news that is coming. With Nebuchadnezzar coming in, every heart is going to melt. Hands will be feeble. Spirits will be faint. Knees will be weak as water. So before it comes and happens, I'm letting the people know ahead of time, and you're going to act like this with the destruction coming upon the people and all their weeping and wailing. Now, Ezekiel did a pretty good job drawing the first map. So then God said, guess what? Draw another one. So then when you get to the latter part of chapter 21, down around verse 18 and through those verses, he then says to Ezekiel, I think around verse 19, I want you to make two ways for the sword of the king of Babylon to come. Right? Okay, the king is coming now from Babylon. You're going to make two ways, kind of show a map here with two routes he can take. He can either go in a route that would take him away from Jerusalem, or he can take a route that would take him to Jerusalem. And guess what, Ezekiel? You're going to show the people that when Nebuchadnezzar comes, he's going straight to Jerusalem for the attack and the destruction. So the symbol is that that king is going to decide to take the road to Jerusalem and then destroy the city. And again, that's what happens in 586 B.C. One other in the chart in chapter 24, and I've got to say, in my opinion, this is the hardest one. I can look a fool and cry in Walmart parking lot. I can look a fool and lay on my side for 390 days. Y'all can put me in the newspaper and ridicule me all you want, but here's one that would really, 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 really bother me. Next thing, an example in action that Ezekiel has to do is God basically says your wife is going to die. But when she dies, you're not allowed to mourn for her. That is tough. In chapter 24, and starting in verse 15, word of the Lord comes to Ezekiel, and this is what God says to him, Son of man, behold, I'm about to take from you the desire of your eyes. Now, men folk, that's a pretty good expression to use when you write a little note or card to your wife, say, you are the desire of my eyes. That's the way God described his wife to Ezekiel. You are the desire of my eyes, but I'm going to take her away from you with a blow. But you shall not mourn, you shall not weep, and your tears shall not come. So verse 18, Ezekiel says, I spoke to the people in the morning, and in the evening, my wife died. And Ezekiel says, now I'm just going to put some words here. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life to obey God in this one. But in the morning, I did as I was commanded. And the people start asking a question about what's going on. And basically, Ezekiel says, in the next column, Jerusalem, 586, is going to fall. Their pride is going to be destroyed with the temple. Loved ones will die. And yet there will be no mourning. I think primarily because folks are going to be taken into captivity. And remember, two-thirds are going to die anyway. It's going to be a mess. Everything Ezekiel does in an action is to convey the message God has for the people. Now, no other prophet has been given or was given
these kinds of instructions like Ezekiel was. Sometimes they may have been instructed in some unusual ways, but throughout Ezekiel's ministry, it was a lot of really kind of weird things he had to do. And it takes a strong person of faith to believe God enough to follow through with what he says when it really makes him look like a fool. That was part of Ezekiel's task.
I wonder what his wife
thought. Ooh, that's good, Gwen. What did his wife think about all that? Because we know what Job's wife said, right? I mean, seriously, it's like, Job, you're an idiot. Curse God and die. Get it over with. Man, that's good. That is good. Because I would imagine, okay, let me say this. We had a guy that preached here one time for revival named Jason Barber. I'll never forget it. In fact, he was the one preaching here in revival when the church got broken into and the fire extinguisher, you know, dust was all over everything. That's when he was the one preaching here, I remember. And I'll never forget him sharing in a sermon about how he had been in a church or some churches where he was crucified all the time by the people. And he said his wife every night was just broken in tears and hurting for what he was dealing with and going through and putting up with. And so that makes me think about it for Ezekiel. I don't think the people are treating Ezekiel very kindly through all of this. They're not listening to him, and yet he has to continue going out there and doing this weird stuff. And for now, okay, this is my question. 390 days on your side, and then flip and cook the other side for 40 days. And I don't know the answer to this question. Is this like a little segment of time for 390 days, or is he truly lying on his side straight, you know, a year and, well, 13 months? Okay, I don't know that. Some of me assumes it was a segment of time for 390 days that he was on his side, and then he'd get up and go home and come back the next day and get back down. I don't know I'm right on that. I may be completely wrong. But either way, his wife is she's watching him every day. I think it takes a lot of faith for her too, not to be like Job's wife and say, "You're an idiot." You know? You know, now that you say that, Gwen, what about old Noah? Right? Same thing, right? He's ridiculed and he's preaching righteousness and 120 years, I think, worth of building ark and preaching, and nobody gets saved except he and his family, and his wife, same way. So maybe the moral of this lesson is be very, very careful who you marry. I'm serious. I'm serious with that. You don't understand. Okay, I won't plan to share this, but I got to because she brought it up. I think I've shared it before. You don't understand. If you think God is calling you into ministry, into like, you know, pastor or evangelist or missionary, whatever, and you're single, and you know, you've got desires to be married and enjoy life with someone, you understand the fear and trepidation when you meet someone, and you better tell them that, because this is what I said. I've shared this a lot of times, maybe not here, but when I met Rhonda, I'll never forget, it's at her home church, and is after a Sunday night service. It's a lot to this story, which is a really neat story. And we were outside talking, and I remember them thinking, like, I got to tell her. And you know what? This is serious. I said, any woman in her right mind, when she hears that you may be considering ministry, she'll have to turn and run. It was nice talking with you. Have a good life. And seriously, that's what I thought. And I'll never forget. And I think I remember looking down, thinking, all right, I guess I'm going to tell her. I mean, it's no need in going any further, right? I mean, it ain't no need in dragging her through anything. And so I said, I think God's calling me into ministry. It's like, all right, it's it. Like, this is going to hurt, but that's it. She's gone. And she said, that's great. Like, she didn't hear me, you know. And so I found out. And listen, that's why I say, God has got to be in it, right? You've got to know. And so then she shared when she was at Radford University. She went to some kind of a collegiate Christian retreat thing. And at that retreat, she separated from all the other kiddos there because she felt like she needed some time alone with God. And in that time, she said, that's when it seemed to me God was telling me, you're going to marry somebody in ministry. And then this guy, standing outside of her home church, says to her, like, I really don't want to tell you this because I know you're going to run, and I don't blame you, but I think God might be calling me to ministry. And when she said, that's great, I thought, what's wrong with her? You know. So now I say that because of what Gwen just said. You know, you think about Noah, you think about some of these figures in the Old Testament, whether it was a male or female, either way, if you're going to really try, you know, to serve God and be real about it, you've got to have a person of like faith, practice, mind, heart with you to do that. Because if not, when things come up, they're going to be like, just curse God and die, you idiot. I mean, that's what Job, so I'm just saying, you got to know. Like, so it's just really important. And so when I do like premarital counseling, that is a major emphasis at the start when I sit down with a couple. And if you're not on the same page spiritually, you're not candidates for marriage. Now, you might find somebody else to do it, and that's fine. And I've turned, well, I'm not saying I've turned a lot away, but I've had a lot of them turn away from me. I mean, honestly, because they didn't want to do things God's way. And I'm like, I'm sorry, sweetheart. I'm not going to bend the word of God to satisfy you or your parents.
Amen.
Honestly. So, anyway, very important with what Gwen said.
So, man, that's good. Poor Ezekiel's wife. Don't know. All right. Anything else from that chart or his experiences that stands out and makes you wonder, like, you know, how in the world did he do all of this? The last thing then, just to kind of throw it out there, the question at the bottom of page 159, I think this is a pretty good connection. They ask the question, how has your life demonstrated the reality of repentance? And not just in your words, but actually in your actions, right? I mean, that's kind of what Ezekiel is dealing with. He's not just following God in his words, but he's also obeying when God says do some kind of strange things. And I've always felt that repentance, by definition, is a change of heart that always leads to a change in direction. Always. If not, then it wasn't real repentance. So I think Ezekiel gives us some some help with that. Okay. That's all I'm doing with Ezekiel. Just to give you some overview. And as you read it later, hopefully, it'll make a little more sense to you. So anything left over from that part? Alright, I don't have time to start it, but I'm going to because we have a little bit here. So if you will turn then to page 161, we're going to talk about the last of the major prophets. After we get through Daniel, all we've got left now are those 12 little Old Testament books, and then we're switching to New Testament time. So we actually are a lot closer than you think to being done with the Old Testament. As we start to talk about Daniel, you can turn to that book, and there may be some things you can mark if you need to or want to as we go. The way the book presents some of the events in Daniel's life is through a quiz. So you get to pretend like you're in school, and I think it's a multiple choice deal. But the difficult thing with multiple choice questions is when there's more than one answer for some of the questions, and some of these have more than one answer. So let's begin talking tonight about Daniel, and then we'll finish up in June, which I think will be 3 weeks from tonight, or 2 weeks from tonight, whatever it is. I think it's three. So look in the very first verse of Daniel. And Daniel says, it was in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim. Okay, Jehoiakim was a king of Judah. Remember your list of kings. You got Israelite kings, kings of the south in Judah. He was a king of Judah. So it was in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, who was king of Judah. Now guess what year that was?
605 B.C. Okay, that's where we're getting the dating of when these things happened in Daniel's life. So you can go through the kings of the Old Testament and get dating for those kings, and then when you find a reference to a year of a king, it helps you know when the events are taking place. So this is in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, who was king of Judah. Now in that year, Nebuchadnezzar, who was king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Okay, remember, Babylon, over here on the map, got their king. They go over to Jerusalem in 605. He sends another group, 597, and brings exiles, 586, final destruction. So Daniel says it was in this very first deportation, okay, in that year of that king's reign, that Nebuchadnezzar came over to Jerusalem, to Judah. And that's when I ended up getting on the train, leaving home, and headed to captivity.
So if you, yeah, we can do this. If we start working through that little quiz there, number one is letter C for the answer. Daniel came to Babylon because he wanted a vacation, not run away. Didn't tell him to preach there. He got to Babylon not of his own will. He got there because the king came in and deported certain people from Jerusalem, and Daniel was one of those people who got deported. Second question, as we set the context for Daniel, is it asks the question, why then was he chosen to be educated in the palace? When Daniel gets to Babylon, he was selected to be educated in Babylonian custom, Babylonian language. And the question is, why was he selected to do that? So when you read through verses 3 and 6, which I'm not going to go through all of that right now, there are three answers to that question for number 2. Number 1, the Bible says he came from a royal family. And there's something about being royalty that catches the attention of others in royalty. So old King Nebuchadnezzar's out there looking over all the captives he's got now in 605 and says, I want the best I can get, right? And he learns that Daniel's coming from a royal family. It's like, hey, we're going to take him. Let's educate him and train him to be a leader here in Babylon. Bible also says, and it's kind of strange, but it also says in verse 4, that they were looking for young guys who were good looking and had intelligence in every branch of wisdom. Do you know how many of us in this church would be eliminated there? Right? He's looking for good looking ones, right? So we wouldn't have to worry about it. We could all get to stay put. But Daniel, see, this is weird. Daniel was recognized as a good looking dude. Like, if Daniel and I were walking down the beach without our shirts on, which is really not a pretty thought, but if we were, you know which one you ladies be looking at? It wouldn't be me. It'd be Daniel, right? He was a good-looking guy. So the king looks there and sees Daniel. The dude is a good-looking guy. He's got a royal family, royal blood. And the third is letter D. He also then qualified to serve there in the king's palace. So the king says, I've got a group of folks coming from Judea, from Judah. I've got a group of folks coming. I want the best of that bunch, and I'm going to train them and let them serve me in my palace. And guess which one of these guys got chosen? It was Daniel. Now, you know, Daniel had three good buddies, and his three good buddies are also chosen in this process. So then look at number 3. Yeah, I think we can do this, and I'll stop. Question number 3, Daniel's buddies, his three friends, they grew up together. Their names were changed. Okay, I don't know if people realize this about the original friends here with Daniel. And I can tell you, the names were not changed to Larry, Moe, and Curly. Although, anyway, kind of funny. But here's what you find. When the king got Daniel and his buddies in the training session and had selected them to serve in the palace, he then gave them Babylonian names. Okay, so he's like, all right, you're not going to use your Jewish name anymore, your Hebrew name. You're going to use now a Babylonian name. You've got a new identity as a servant here in Babylon in my palace. So when you get down to verse 6-ish, yes. So when he grabs different ones and educates them for 3 years, it says, they then enter the king's service. Now among them from the sons of Judah, taken in this round of exile, among them were four guys. There was one named Daniel. There was one named Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Okay, this is their Hebrew names. When they were growing up, everybody knew them by these names. But then it says in verse 7, the commander of the officials assign new names to them. Okay, we need to convert them, make them Babylonian now and not Hebraic or Jewish. So, Daniel was given the name Belteshazzar. Hananiah was given the name Shadrach. Mishael was given the name Meshach. And Azariah was given the name Abednego. Now, here's what's always confused me in the story of Daniel. We'll talk about this more when we get back to it. Throughout the story of Daniel, Daniel is all referred to as Daniel, and not by the Babylonian name. But I almost guarantee not a single one of us in here tonight could have given the three names of these three friends except for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know what? Those are not their home. That's not their given names. That's not their Jewish names. That's their Babylonian names. So throughout the story, Daniel kind of keeps referring to himself as Daniel, but his three buddies are referred to as a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but their names really are Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. So let's see, letter B or number three. Yes, the answer there is letter B with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay, this starts the story of Daniel. They're taken in captivity, 605, got some buddies with him. Ezekiel is not there yet, right? He goes in the second deportation. Daniel's one of the first ones over in Babylon. He's in Babylon with his ministry. Jeremiah's back home in Jerusalem with his ministry. About 8 years later, Ezekiel joins Daniel in Babylon with his ministry, all the weird actions he does. And then finally, 11 years after that, the entire city is destroyed. And there's complete captivity in Babylon. So that's an introduction to Daniel. And I'm going to stop with that.